goal of the flotilla, besides breaking the siege and opening a humanitarian corridor to Gaza, is to show people that Gaza is a real place. It's not an abstract location. Gaza exists. It's there. Real people are living there and are living under attack, despite the fact that our governments just pretend that nothing is happening and that Israel is not breaking international law every day in Palestine, but also attacking these humanitarian flotillas. So one of the consequences of these flotillas is trying to make our governments take a stand, trying to pressure the European Commission, the European institutions to take a stand. And it is unfortunate that we need to have European citizens and European parliamentarians in boats towards Gaza to make our governments say something about Israel. It is unfortunate that we need a Portuguese boat with a Portuguese flag being attacked with Portuguese citizens and parliamentarians on board by some, I wouldn't say that the drone has no flag, but we know who has interest in and who gains from these attacks. And it is unfortunate that we need these for the Portuguese government to say something about the genocide and to say something about Gaza. But if this is what it takes, then we'll continue with the flotilla to open the humanitarian corridor and to make sure that all governments in the world have to say something about the genocide. They have to recognize the genocide.
Mariana Mortágua, we want to thank you very much for being with us. Portuguese parliamentarian on one of the boats, part of the flotilla that hopes to challenge Israel's siege on Gaza. And Saif Aboukeshek, Palestinian activist based in Barcelona. Both are taking part in the global Sumud flotilla. And as we wrap up today here in New York, a moment of silence was observed at 8:46 a.m. this morning to mark 24 years since the September 11th attacks. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO's Loud and Proud. Become a member during our KBOO Out Loud Fall Membership Drive taking place now through September 20th. Your contribution goes towards grassroots, independent, radically made community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give and help us reach our $45,000 goal. Thank you.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from 988 Oregon, a public service helping those who are feeling sad, struggling with alcohol or drug use, or just need someone to talk to. Trained counselors are able to listen and provide support 24/7. Confidential support available by text or phone call to 988. More info at 988oregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, a Beaverton preschool and two national teachers' unions join a suit to stop ICE arrests on school grounds. Washington must destroy some of its abortion pill stockpile since it's expiring. And Multnomah County joins four other Oregon counties in quarantine for the emerald ash borer beetle. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 11th, 2025. KABU is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kabu.fm/give. I'm Eric Leuschner. Two national teachers' unions and a Beaverton preschool join a lawsuit seeking to bar ICE arrests on school grounds. In July, a parent of a preschooler at Guidepost Montessori was forcibly arrested while dropping off his child. ICE shattered the window of his car and took him into custody. Agents also shoved the head of the school, who was filming the encounter. The school, the parents, and teachers who witnessed the arrest, and two national teachers' unions joined the suit filed in April in Eugene. The American Federation of Teachers and the National Education Association joined, saying ICE arrests have had a major negative impact on students, families, and the teachers they represent. Several churches, an interfaith group, and an Oregon farmworkers' union filed the suit originally in July to restore sanctuary protections for sensitive locations. Prior to Trump taking office earlier this year, ICE would not detain people at schools, churches, or medical offices. Attorneys for the plaintiffs say the added groups will strengthen the lawsuit. It is still pending before a district judge in Eugene. Immigrant rights groups and others are calling on lawmakers to protect people facing federal conspiracy charges for protesting ICE detentions in Spokane. The groups say tactics used by ICE against immigrant communities and protesters are violating their rights. Isabel Charlet reports.
Over 60 organizations across Washington state have signed a letter urging officials to enhance protections for immigrants and to drop all federal charges against ICE protesters. Immigrant rights advocates say tactics by police and federal immigration officers are escalating after 37 people were arrested at a June protest in Spokane. A month later, 9 more activists were arrested from their homes and cars and hit with federal conspiracy charges. Liz Moore of the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane calls the arrest an abuse of federal power.
Both our neighbors are being terribly targeted because of the color of their skin or because of their status as immigrants. And that targeting is expanding to include people who are showing up for our neighbors using our First Amendment rights.
The letter includes a call to use tax dollars to fund emergency aid for immigrant communities that are impacted by increased ICE activity in the state. The Trump administration says it is following through with its promise to carry out the largest mass deportation in U.S. history. Local charges against the June protesters were dropped, but federal charges against the 9 arrested later remain. PJAL's volunteer Amy Manning says it's unusual for federal charges to be pursued without local law enforcement involvement. She notes that 2 of the accused are leaders of the Spokane Coalition Against Racism.
It does feel like an attack on our leadership, our ability to stand up for our neighbors, our ability to take that risk.
A broad swath of people and organizations have signed on to the letter, including churches and direct service providers. Reverend Emily Kinker with the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America spoke yesterday at a press conference.
Scripture calls on us to welcome the stranger, to stand up for the marginalized, to defend the foreigner. As people of faith, we are here to answer that call.
For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
Texas's latest abortion bill is being met with legal challenges. House Bill 7 gives private citizens the right to sue anyone who distributes, manufactures, or mails abortion medication into the state. Opponents say Texas is trying to push its laws into other states, and the case will probably end up before the Supreme Court. Frieda Ross has more on the story.
Texas could soon have another law on the books aimed at strengthening its strict abortion ban. House Bill 7, passed by the legislature, gives private citizens the right to sue anyone who distributes, manufactures, or mails abortion medication into the state. Legislative counsel for Avow Texas, Blake Rocap, says the bill doesn't target expectant mothers.
Texans who are pregnant and don't wish to be can still travel to other states where abortion is legal. The bill does not allow a pregnant person themselves to be sued, and their having an abortion is not illegal. People in Texas will still be able to see a doctor in another state.
Under the bill, Texans can sue for up to $100,000. Supporters of the legislation say it protects the unborn and pregnant women from what they call poisonous illegal drugs. The current Texas abortion ban only allows doctors in the state to prescribe abortion medication if the mother's life is in danger. Pregnant people have gotten around the law by leaving leaving the state or seeing an out-of-state doctor through telehealth appointments. ROCAP says anti-abortion lawmakers hope HB 7 closes that loophole.
Texas has not been able to export these regulation of abortion to other states. So this law is an attempt to export Texas's policy preferences across the country.
Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has sued a New York County clerk for refusing to file a judgment against a doctor accused of prescribing abortion drugs to a Texas woman. Doctors in some states without abortion bans are protected by shield laws. The legislation allows for a lawsuit to be filed if the plaintiff claims someone intends to violate the law. ROCAP says he believes the cases will eventually go before the Supreme Court.
By setting up the enforcement like this and creating the cause of action only for intent, the anti-abortion movement doesn't have to wait for any actual facts or activity to happen, nor do they have to wait for any particular person to be able to claim harm.
I'm Frieda Ross, Texas News Service.
Washington State is set to destroy a huge number of abortion pills. But the federal environment concerning abortion access and a lawsuit down in Texas are even more concerning. KBOO's Josh Salem tells us more.
Washington State is preparing to destroy a huge abortion pill stockpile because 30,000 doses are set to expire at the end of January. There would still be some left over. The stockpile would have thousands more pills not set to expire for several more years. Washington's governor at the time, Jay Inslee, authorized the purchase of the first-of-its-kind stockpile of 30,000 doses of mifepristone in 2023. It was supposed to act as a three-year insurance policy in case the drug was no longer available due to the restrictions at the federal level in Washington. Perhaps surprisingly, that has not yet been an issue. Following the 2022 U.S. Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, availability of mifepristone and misoprostol, two abortion-inducing drugs, has become critical in order for people to continue accessing the procedure. Many Republican-led states banned abortions after the decision, and some states have wanted to limit access to the drugs. For Washington State, the possibility of federal regulation looms larger. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has repeatedly signaled a willingness to limit access to mifepristone. While testifying before Congress last week, he suggested rolling back the access to abortion pills, which had been expanded under President Biden. Earlier this summer, a federal judge ruled that providers must be specifically certified to prescribe mifepristone. Washington and other states argued this would be a barrier to access, noting overwhelming amounts of research have demonstrated the drug's safety. In Washington state, Inslee okayed the purchase of another 17,600 doses shortly before leaving office in January. The 30,000 pills about to be destroyed cost $1.275 million. The state can only provide mifepristone to qualified clinics and prescribers and has to sell it for at least the price for which it was purchased. Providers can still get pills for less from wholesalers. The extra 17,600 doses also expire in late 2028 and early 2029. For that purchase, the supplier agreed to exchange unused doses for new pills at no cost to the state. The University of Washington had its own 10,000-pill stockpile of mifepristone, but all of it has been distributed to clinics in the state. Recently, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected a challenge to mifepristone from abortion opponents due to a legal technicality. Idaho, Kansas, and Missouri are now asking a federal judge in Texas to make it much harder to get prescribed drug, which has been approved since 2000. Experts think removing the Texas pills will block access nationwide. A more significant blow to abortion access in Washington state is the $8.5 million cut in this year's biennial state budget. In 2024, medication abortions accounted for about 68% of all abortions in Washington. The most common complication was the pill not working, but hospitalizations occurred less than 0.2% of the time. More than 3,000 of the abortions conducted through medication were done via telemedicine. Last month, attorneys general in more than 13 states petitioned the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to remove restrictions on mifepristone access, including the prescriber certification requirement. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Turning Point USA co-founder Charlie Kirk killed while speaking at a Utah Valley university. A government shutdown looms as Dems and GOP hit an impasse, and the Senate considers a rule change to speed up nomination votes. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We are all horrified watching images and following the news out of Utah, and we are sending all of our thoughts to Mr. Kirk, to his family, to survivors there.
Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy speaking from the Senate floor. While speaking at Utah Valley University, Turning Point USA co-founder Charlie Kirk was shot in the neck and died. At that moment, Kirk was actually answering questions about mass shooters over the last decade, asserting many were transgender. Controversial statements like this were a centerpiece of Kirk's activism and helped him capture the voice of young conservatives nationwide. And Utah Governor Spencer Cox is calling Kirk's death a political assassination. Political violence is intensifying in America. Two Minnesota Democratic lawmakers were shot in June, and assailants set fire to the Pennsylvania governor's mansion in April, and the New Mexico Republican headquarters were set on fire in March. Most prominently, two would-be assassins attempted to shoot President Donald Trump when he was running for re-election. Many historians tie the pattern to angry and virulent rhetoric. Meanwhile, the partisanship continues in Congress as another government shutdown looms. Lawmakers have until September 30th to pass a funding bill, but the sides seem to be at an impasse. Speaker of the House Mike Johnson says he's confident a budget bill will pass, although he accuses Democrats of, quote, taking the path of maximum resistance.
It's not surprising. They're struggling because they don't really have a message or a leader. Their party registration is falling. Their approval ratings are in the low 20s, and they're about to elect a Marxist to be the mayor of New York City.
Democrats say they want restoration of some healthcare funding cut in the tax and budget mega bill, and some of them say they want Congress to defend its power of the purse against illegal White House overreach. Trump is calling for lawmakers to push the deadline to the end of January with agencies funded at current levels. Senate Republicans are proposing a new rule to speed up confirmation of lower-level Trump officials. It would allow multiple nominees to be considered in a group. They argue Democrats are slowing down a traditionally speedy process, although Democrats say they're just negotiating with the administration. Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says they're resorting to this after talks fell apart in August.
Rather than giving those talks another chance, Republicans would rather change how the Senate operates to weaken this chamber's traditional and powerful sense of deliberation.
He adds Trump's nominees, many of whom face criticism for extremist views, would get worse without the check provided by the confirmation process. Republican Senate Leader John Thune, who introduced the measure, calls the objections a, quote, temper tantrum over Trump.
And so they've destroyed decades upon decades of Senate precedent and turned a historically bipartisan process into an exercise in petty partisanship.
Arizona Democratic Senator Ruben Gallego is denouncing the decision to give deceased veteran Ashley Babbitt military funeral honors. Though Babbitt served in the Air Force and the Air National Guard, she was part of the mob that stormed the Capitol on January 6, 2021. She was shot and killed by a U.S. Capitol police officer after being warned not to break into the Speaker's lobby. Gallego says military honors should remain sacred.
To give them to Babbitt would be a spit in the face to all of them and to every veteran who died defending this country.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $45,000 by September 20th. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. At 6 o'clock, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear with an overnight low of 61. Tomorrow's weather will be clear and sunny with a daytime high of 76. Today in history, in 1973, a coup in Chile by General Augusto Pinochet topples the democratically elected president Salvador Allende. Pinochet had financial and intelligence support for the coup from the U.S. He ruled as a dictator until 1990, torturing and interring tens of thousands of Chileans and executing some 3,000 critics. The quote of the day is from English novelist D.H. Lawrence, who said, quote, "What man most passionately wants is his living wholeness and his living unison, not his own isolate salvation of his soul. Man wants his physical fulfillment first and foremost, since now, once and once only, he is in the flesh and potent For man, the vast marvel is to be alive. For man, as for flower and beast and bird, the supreme triumph is to be most vividly, most perfectly alive. Emerald ash borer beetles were discovered near the David Douglas Aquatic Center. Now Multnomah County joins four others in a quarantine. The beetles have killed hundreds of millions of ash trees across the continent. KBOO's Althea Billings first reported on the threat of the beetles in 2022.
The emerald ash borer. It's a green, wood-boring beetle that is responsible for the destruction of tens of millions of ash trees in North America. In June 2022, the beetle was found in Forest Grove, Oregon. That was the furthest west in the continental United States that it's been seen. Michael Spalding is the district manager in Portland at the Davy Tree Expert Company. He explains.
The emerald ash borer gets its name because it's a bright green metallic color. It's an invasive beetle that's killed hundreds of millions of trees all over the U.S., Midwest, East Coast, Southeast, all the way up to Denver. And now it's just across the Rockies and it's here. It decimates these trees typically from the top down, but typically on the warmer side. So you'll probably find signs of the emerald ash borer on the south facing side of the tree in the canopy. And you'll see thinning and decline fairly rapidly. And these pests move much faster than a bronze birch borer that we've had here for quite a while. They move very fast. And the way that they take apart the tree from the inside, they make them very brittle, very dangerous, and hard to remove once it's about a 30% canopy dieback. And they're very, very fast and invasive.
Dr. Barry Lyons is a research scientist at the Great Lakes Forestry Center. He explained to Natural Resources Canada how the emerald ash borer kills ash trees.
The eggs laid on the trunk of the tree under a bark chip or in a bark crevice. The tiny larva, when it emerges from that egg, chews its way down through the bark to the surface of the wood. So it occurs in that interface between the wood and the bark, and the larva starts to form a gallery there. Well, that tissue in that area is very important for transporting nutrients up and down the tree and transporting water up the tree. And so as the larva feed, they damage some of those vessels that transport the fluids, and that eventually girdles the tree and causes the death of the tree.
There are signs that an ash tree has been infested with the emerald ash borer. Experts point to a thinning crown of the tree, long shoots growing from the trunk or branches, small D-shaped holes in the bark where the beetles emerge from, and S-shaped holes under the bark that are filled with a fine sawdust. All of these are signs that the emerald ash borer is impacting the tree. Arborists don't yet know how the native Oregon ash will fare against this threat.
We are going to find out how susceptible the native Oregon ash is. Those are planted all over. A lot of the green ash trees are typically planted as street trees and in planters and in like parking lots. You find those quite a lot on the street. So I lived in Chicago for 3 years during the hard thick of the ash pandemic when this was going on as a consulting arborist. And it was really hard to convey the importance of treating the trees prior to them being infested. And after it got about a 20% canopy dieback, it's not worth treating anymore and should be removed. There was a lot of money spent with municipalities. There was a lot of heartache with prized trees in people's properties that had to be removed. It decimates every ash tree in the area.
The emerald ash borer is native to northeastern Asia, and ash trees there co-evolved with the beetle to have stronger defenses. Scientists believe the beetle was brought to North America around 2002 in wood packaging from Asia. Climate change has also made these emerald ash borer infestations worse. Spalding explains.
Climate change stresses out the trees with our longer, hotter, drier summers. And with a stressed tree, you have a weakened immune system, just like a human being. It's more difficult for the tree to fight off the pests. And you also see multiple seasons of these pests. So instead of having one generational cycle, you'll have three or four generational cycles because of a longer, hotter, drier, livable season for them.
People can act now to protect local ash trees from the emerald ash borer beetle, Spalding says. But it's important not to wait until the beetle has already started in on the tree.
Well, the most important thing you can do is keep the health of the tree boosted. So you need to be doing deep root treatments and bringing nutrients to the tree, as well as you have to be treating the tree with an insecticide, an internal insecticide that's targeted for the emerald ash borer. It's a probe about 8 inches long, and you step it down, and it's a high-pressure injection that goes in deep into the soil, all around the root flares, the soil profile, all beneath the canopy of the tree. And if they're not treated, it's almost a guarantee that if the tree's not treated, it will be taken out.
For KBOO News, I'm Althea Billings.
The emerald ash borer quarantine restricts the movement of materials from ash trees, white fringe, and olive trees. Think logs, green lumber, mulch, stumps, roots, branches, and most of all, firewood. That quarantine covers Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington, Marion, and Yamhill counties. Ash trees were a relatively common street tree in Portland, but since the ash borer infestation was predicted, the city has moved away from planting new ones or recommending them. The Department of Urban Forestry treated 654 ash trees against the beetle in Portland parks so far, with more planned later this week. Ash trees play an important ecological role in Oregon, shading waterways, reducing erosion on stream banks, and providing a food source for wildlife. A tribal college in North Dakota indicates a memorial for a former U.S. concentration camp. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. During World War II, at least 100,000 Japanese Americans were forced into so-called internment camps across the U.S. Seen by the government as a potential threat within America's borders, memories of the mass incarceration still burns hot for former prisoners and their families. Senior reporter Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports on a Native American college that held a special dedication to preserve that history.
About 200 people gathered at the Snow Country Prison Japanese American Memorial last week at the United Tribes Technical College in Bismarck. Taiko and Native drummers performed together as dignitaries honored the 1,850 Japanese men who were confined here back when the site was known as Fort Lincoln. Satsuki Ina was born in a California internment camp in 1944, and her father, Itaru, was kept at Fort Lincoln in 1945 through 1946. Her book, The Poet and the Silk Girl, is a memoir based on her parents' letters, diaries, and her father's haiku. The memorial is the culmination of 25 years that Ina and the UTTC worked together to preserve this history.
There were trees that the Japanese-American prisoners had planted, and there was this story that there were ghosts that wandered around, and that when the wind blew on these trees, it sounded like somebody was crying. So there was actually a healer that would come every once in a while and bless those trees. So when I heard stories like that, I felt like the memory of their presence was really being protected and honored.
Ina says there are efforts by the Trump administration to erase or dismiss past atrocities against communities of color. So she sees the UTTC's support, including giving some of its property to the memorial, as key to keeping history accurate and the government accountable.
This is, in many ways, an act of solidarity with the Native people and the Japanese Americans. And the lesson is, it's in our collaboration, our solidarity with each other, that we strengthen our truths and stand in opposition to efforts to erase our history, to alter it, to rewrite our narratives in ways that don't talk about the truth.
At the end of the dedication ceremony, a Japanese and Native flute player performed together as visitors placed paper crayons on the names of those incarcerated at Fort Lincoln. These were inscribed on slate tiles that once lined the barracks. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Bismarck.
Over the summer at the University of South Dakota, 20 high school students attended the annual Oscar Howe Summer Art Institute, learning from each other and renowned Native American artists. The camps inspired by artist Oscar Howe, who paved the way for Native artists to challenge stereotypes, teaching at the university for more than two decades. Instructor Keith Braveheart helped students learn about Howe's approach to art, recounting his first experience with the Trailblazers' legacy.
It felt like the work was alive, like it was physically breathing, like it was pulsating. And I know that it could have been an optical illusion because of the way that he designs his work, but I also later would truly believe that it was imbued with a Dakota spirit.
Braveheart studied in one of the Institute's many iterations as a student.
I see this potential that what was my path, my journey, what that could be like, might be similar to a next generation of an artist, a younger artist.
A citizen of the Oglala Sioux tribe, Braveheart says he thinks creating those future pathways is what Oscar Howe envisioned. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The chicken or pork you can buy at the grocery store is often processed and packaged by someone at a large facility. Labor experts say these workers endure fast-paced and demanding conditions, and there's renewed debate in Washington, D.C. about permanently adjusting line speed limits for processing equipment. Mike Moen has a story in South Dakota.
Worker safety at U.S. meatpacking plants is back at the forefront with a congressional plan to permanently increase line speeds for processing pork and poultry. Supporters say companies need certainty, but labor voices in South Dakota worry about more injuries. Adjustments to line speed rules are often the result of USDA actions, depending on who's in the White House. Both Trump administrations have prioritized faster speeds. The GOP-led bill in Congress would create a permanent framework to ensure plants can maintain full operational capacity. B.J. Motley leads the union representing workers at South Dakota's Smithfield Foods plant. He's skeptical of the idea, saying conditions are already taxing.
So the workers basically on the line 8 hours, you know, with a little break here, a little break there, but it's continuously run now. And I think that's putting a lot more pressure on employees in their workstations.
He says the timing is also bad, with increased immigration enforcement affecting staffing. Motley says that puts remaining workers at risk for injury with repetitive motions to keep up with faster production standards. The bill's sponsor says processors would have to meet certain criteria before speeding things up. He argues the plan would bring U.S. meat and poultry firms closer to global competitiveness. And supporters say these companies and farmers would no longer be at the mercy of inconsistent rules. But Motley is part of the opposition questioning the motives behind these plans.
It's all about greed, because you're not losing any production anywhere.
In 2021, a federal court struck down the USDA's rule eliminating line speed limits, a plan pursued by the first Trump administration. The agency later